The Last Word with Matt Cooper.
In a moment, we'll be joined by Alan Shatter and Lisa Chambers. But before we talk to them, Daniel McConnell, editor of the Business Post, is with us. Because there's a couple of things I'm going to talk to them about. One is the government scaling back its intentions in relation to the hate crime legislation and particularly withdrawing hate speech elements to the bill. What's going on?
So the government has looked towards, and Helen McEntee in particular has looked to bribe, to essentially bring Ireland into line with the European Convention around hate speech and the idea of, you know, you can't go after people on the basis of their identity, their gender, etc. like that. So the vast majority of the bill in terms of hate crime, there's no problem with. There's a consensus, the political consensus there, that it needs to be, give police more powers to essentially kind of deal with more radical elements. The area that has been most controversial is this idea of hate speech. And the difficulty the government has gotten into, it hadn't included a clear definition of what hate constituted. So therefore, it was being attacked on all sides. On the left, it was deemed not to be going far enough. And on the right, it was deemed it was an attack on freedom of speech, an attack on being able to voice valid and legitimate opinions. And Helen McEntee essentially being called, you know, trying to defend, essentially, in my view, the indefensible. I think the legislation is pretty flawed. And, you know, she's admitted over the weekend in a series of media commentary that that aspect of the bill will now be held, but she will proceed with the remainder of the bill.
You said that there was objections from both the left and from the right, but how wide was that objection? It was not the majority of people quite happy with it. The majority of TDs had voted this through the Dáil in various stages without having a problem until small vocal elements on either extreme got going on this.
Yeah, I think that's probably fair, but I think those extremes, if you want to call it that way, tended to have been either, you know, well-defined or well-experienced people have articulated the rights of freedom of speech and conscience, and therefore have held sway people like Michael McDougall, who've been very notable in their commentary. And Michael McDougall, and you might remember in 2011, he and other former attorneys general almost single-handedly stopped a government proposal to give more powers to Oireachtas Committee. So they were the type of people who have power and who have influence, and they certainly brought that influence to bear. And Helen McEntee, I think, was being criticised, particularly around the lack of a definition of what hate constituted. And I think there was legitimate fears from some of our colleagues, and you know, who've written in the Business Post on this, Matt, who said, "Listen, you know, one person's freedom of speech is another person's. You know, it goes over the top, or one person's offence is another person's just hard opinion." And I think if there's any ambiguity in law breeds trouble, and there was trouble written all over.
But there
this
are
bill.
People who abuse free speech, who are the type of people who would shout fire in a crowded room, who deliberately use it to incite hatred against people, and even if they aren't themselves the type who might be involved in violence, would incite others to do so. So is there not a need to address that?
There probably is, and I think there's, you know, a legitimate desire, I think, to put extreme voices and extreme characters like that, not give them a kind of a platform to articulate without any sort of responsibility. Like, we can't publish whatever we want. We are subject to the laws of defamation in this country. But at the end of the day, I'm a free speech advocate, and I would be very loath to get into a space where, just on the grounds of offence, we're limiting the freedom of speech.
Okay, but you've mentioned, I mean, what might be loosely termed intellectuals on the left and the right who had difficulties with the legislation, but weren't the loudest voices some of those who would actually look to abuse free speech and who have been involved in quite serious antisocial behaviour, to put it mildly, and anti-immigrant and often racist behaviour? Is there not a danger that the government here has given in to the mob?
And that's certainly a viewpoint, I think, being articulated by the Labour leader, Ivana Bacic. We also know that this legislation has been criticised by the likes of Elon Musk.
And that's saying something.
That says something, of course. I just think, you know, albeit while it may have been well-intentioned, I don't think the execution of this legislation was robust enough, and I think ultimately the decision to withdraw it or park it comes down that there wasn't a political consensus around it.
We'll talk more to Alan Shatter and Lisa Chambers about that in a few moments, but something else we're going to be talking to them about is President Michael D. Higgins and the letter he sent to the new Iranian president, and how that came up at the United Nations last night, and how he claimed that Israel was somehow responsible for leaking the letter. that doesn't look correct, does it? Has he made a claim that he can substantiate there?
Well, he hasn't been able to substantiate it yet, and I think we're all eyes to see exactly how he manages or backs up that particular claim. I suppose the wider context of this...
But sorry, isn't it the case that Iran widely publicised that it had received this letter from Michael D. Higgins? Israel took advantage of that and was able to put it out on its own social media channels, in media commentary and whatever. But that if the letter hadn't been written in the first place, the Iranians wouldn't have been able to publish it and the Israelis wouldn't have been able to publicise it.
Two things, I think, absolutely. The letter was written, and I think the defence from government is that this was a letter written, essentially, this is normal diplomatic kind of communications between the head of one state to another, and ultimately setting out the role of Israel in terms of violence since October 7th last year, etc., etc. I think the Israelis' beef with this, essentially, is that it makes no mention of, I suppose, the attack that Israel constantly finds itself in. And Ireland has found itself more at odds with Israel over the events of the last year or so.
But Iran is the sponsor of terrorism. Iran is the sponsor of Hezbollah. So should we be maintaining friendly relations with a country which sponsors terrorism with the aim of destroying another state?
The constant refrain from government when issues around rogue nations, as they might want to be called, come up is you're better off having diplomatic relations with them than not. For example, if an Irish citizen was to find himself lost in Tehran or elsewhere, it's important to have those relations so the diplomatic service can do its business and get those Irish people to safety. It was the same with Russia after the invasion of Ukraine. We've heard calls for Ireland's relationship with Israel to essentially be suspended, diplomatic relations. We've seen this before. The government's firm view always has been it's better off to have relations of some sort, be they friendly or not, rather than having no relationship at all.
Which is why we maintain relations with Israel, although many people would think many of the acts of the last week in particular, and even leaving aside Gaza in relation to Hezbollah, have been at the best verging on terrorism. So where is Taoiseach Simon Harrison at present, given that he is in New York at the United Nations?
So, I mean, all eyes are, I suppose, on his commentary in around this, given where, as you say, he's at the United Nations, and this is the sort of set piece event every year where all leaders go to the United Nations General Assembly. So Simon Harris, since the get-go, has been out, very strident in his views on Israel. I mean, he at his first Ordesh speech, looked down the barrel of the camera and said to Benjamin Netanyahu, stop your insidious aggression. Ultimately, he says that, Israel... and in his commentary today, he's basically said the burden is on the author to defend this content, which not mentioned the threat that Iran poses in this region. He also went on to say that Israel is continuing to allow a horrific humanitarian situation to continue, and he said the Israel embassy should be focusing on things other than amplifying, circulating or referencing a letter that he says, in his view, does conform with normal diplomatic protocol and relations.
Thank you very much, Daniel McConnell, editor of The Business Post. And we're joined now by Alan Shatter, former Minister for Justice and Chair of the Inheritance Tax Reform Campaign, and Senator Lisa Chambers of Fianna Fáil. Alan Shatter, we're going to deal first, please, with the issue in relation to this letter that President Michael D. Higgins sent to Iran on the nomination of its new president, something you've highlighted in recent months. It's back in the public eye at present. But what do you make of what Danny McConnell said there, that the government position is, well, look, even if you don't necessarily like foreign states, you have to try and maintain talking relationships with them, reasonably friendly, to actually maybe get places?
Well, look, I understand that, having been in government, but the reality is that the letter the president sent is quite extraordinary. It's quite bizarre and it's completely inappropriate. Matt, as you correctly said, Iran is basically the main focus for proxy terrorist organizations, Islamic fanatical organizations throughout the Middle East. The regime in Iran is a tyrannical regime. It regularly hangs people for no reason other than being gay. It persecutes women. It's murdered women for seeking some freedom in their lives. It's created terrible difficulties throughout the Middle East and is recognized by the United States as the global center of terrorism. Now, this letter is not a normal letter. I appreciate we may wish to maintain diplomatic relations with Iran, but we are not compelled to embrace Iran and engage in fantasy politics. The actual letter welcoming the new president to his position in Iran references the peaceful resolution of disputes being important across the Middle East, and knowledge that that Iran, with its long tradition of culture, would play a crucial role in achieving this. Now, the reality is, at the present time, the major conflicts in the Middle East derive from Iran's commitment, as you mentioned, to Israel's total destruction, its funding, training and weaponizing of Hamas, Hezbollah, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, and the Houthis, and other terrorist groups that form part of its so-called axis of resistance. There are, in the context of the conflicts taking place, hundreds of rockets on a daily basis flying into Israel. Those coming from Lebanon have, throughout the last 12 months, regularly not been reported by anyone in the Irish media. And Iran is at the centre of terrorism. To engage in fantasy politics and pretend they've some interest in the peaceful resolution of disputes flies in the face of fact, because Iran is also opposed to a ceasefire of the Israeli-Gaza war on any terms that do not enable the brutal Hamas terrorist group to continue and regain its governance of Gaza. So this is fantasy politics. It's very damaging. I don't believe there are other EU states whose prime minister or president have felt such a welcoming, embracing communication to the president of Iran. The other piece of this is frankly quite bizarre. Is if this letter was sent, firstly, there should have been transparency. There's no reason why it shouldn't be in the public domain. There's no basis for the very odd complaint, I understand, made by the president. And apparently, as I understand it, it was the Iranian embassy in Dublin that actually published this letter on social media. Why the president is suggesting there's some Israeli or Jewish conspiracy to leak something that he himself should have put in the public domain in the first place, I frankly don't understand.
Okay, Lisa Chambers, why is the government being so supportive of Michael D. Higgins in relation to this?
Well, I don't think it's that they're being so supportive. It's more, I mean, I've read the Taoiseach's comments where he said that this was, I suppose, the normal way in terms of diplomacy and maintaining open channels with other countries, and it will be in the normal course of the president's work and, of course, the government's work to send a letter when a new government is elected or if somebody had passed away ahead of state. So it's not unusual to send letters of this nature.
You mean, is it a bit like sending condolences to Germany on Hitler's death, is it?
Well, look, I take on board what Alan has said. I don't disagree with anything he has said about Iran and their funding of Hezbollah and the destabilization that they have created in the Middle East. And certainly the values that we hold dear in terms of rule of law and protection of human rights and civil rights in Ireland, they do not espouse those values. So I'm not disagreeing with that. All I can put on the record here is that the Taoiseach and the Taoiseach have basically said it's not unusual to send letters of this nature in terms of diplomacy, but I take on board the comments made by former Minister Shatter.
Alan Shatter, back to you. There's a lot of our listeners saying that if that's the approach you believe should be taken towards Iran because of a sponsorship of terrorism, that we should be doing the same in relation to Israel, that much of what it has done with the pager bombs last week and now today's assault on Lebanon should similarly be regarded as terrorism.
I'll come back to that, Matt, but just let me say one additional thing of relevance to this. I find it personally difficult to be critical of Michael D. Higgins as our president. We soldiered together for many years in the Foreign Affairs Committee. We both visited Israel and Palestinian territories together. I can recall being in Sderot, an Israeli town that suffered terrible atrocities on October 7 at the hands of Hamas. On an occasion, we were there at a meeting when unexpectedly a rocket was fired out of Gaza and we had to take immediate cover, 15 seconds, to be safe. But the problem throughout, from my friendship as a political colleague with Michael D. As prior to being president, has been he has always had a blind spot to the impact of Islamic terrorism, to the malign role of Iran. And sadly and unfortunately, this less than normal letter sent to a rogue state that carries out terrorism simply should not be sent.
Okay.
And it's and very unfortunate.
We had that, but what about what I said to you in relation to Israel's behaviour and whether it is now at this stage should be regarded as a terrorist state itself because of the method by which it is persecuting war?
Well, the truth of the current conflict, if we continue with Hezbollah for a moment, from October the 8th, Hezbollah commenced firing rockets indiscriminately into Israel. At this stage, the number of rockets fired exceeds 8,000. Hundreds of rockets have been fired in the last 12 days, and there's a war. And the reality is it's a war Hezbollah created. Israel didn't look for this war. Israel has a right under international law to defend its state and its citizens. And the tragedy for people in Lebanon is that Hezbollah, like Hamas in Gaza, has encased itself within communities, has established armaments and rockets within homes and apartments, and is using, as Hamas has done, civilians as human shields. And what the Israelis are doing is trying to protect their own citizens. 70,000 Israelis have had to move out of their homes in along the Lebanese border in northern Israel. And again, this conflict would end tomorrow if Hezbollah start firing bombs, and they are firing their missiles and bombs and rockets indiscriminately at population centres. And
But Alan, how many Israeli people have died since Hezbollah started firing those rockets back last October? Because we know that there are at least 265 dead today in one day alone in Lebanon, countless more injured, the death toll is likely to rise, and there's going to be mass displacement of people, far more than the 70,000 you've referred to in Israel.
Matt, I wish this war would end. I wish there was a resolution. I wish there was a ceasefire of a permanent nature and normal diplomatic relations existed within this region. But that is not the case. And the unfortunate reality is the way that question is put, and I know this is not your intention, but I've seen this said previously. It's to some extent a complaint that while a war is taking place, not enough Israelis have died. And the reason not many beyond a few hundred Israelis have died is because they have bomb shelters and they have a system to intercept rockets and indiscriminately firing at Israel. Hezbollah, like Hamas, locates themselves within civilian areas. They have spent huge sums of money on armaments, but they do not provide bomb shelters for civilians because they use civilians as human shields and then use the tragic civilian deaths that take place for propaganda purposes. What you don't know, and what I frankly don't know, is how many who've died in recent days are Hezbollah terrorists and how many are civilians who tragically have been cut up in this terrible war. This war, both wars, would end tomorrow if Hamas in Gaza released the hostages, did what the IRA did, which is end the armed struggle and agree to a peaceful resolution of conflict. The Gaza war would end and the war involving Lebanon would end. But tragically, instead of ending, this is escalating, and it's pure fantasy to believe that Iran has any interest in this region other than creating chaos and escalating conflict.
Okay, I want to quickly ask you about the hate crime legislation. And Lisa Chambers, first to you, the hate speech legislation. Why has the government caved in relation to this when you have had extreme views been put by the likes of Elon Musk interfering in our nation's affairs, and when you've had a mob mentality develop in relation to it? Why being politically cowardly and why give it up?
Well, a couple of things there, Matt. I don't know why Elon Musk keeps getting mentioned. He has no bearing on...
Have you not followed Twitter and what the campaign he's tried to wage against the hate speech laws?
Yeah, and it should have no bearing on our discussions in our own country on the laws that we pass, and it has no bearing on my views on legislation. And he can say what he wants, but he's not a citizen of this country and he's got no impact, as far as I'm concerned, in terms of our legislation. I think it's wise to drop the hate speech element of it. I was I'm on the record over a year ago as having raised significant concerns around this. The Fianna Fáil Parliamentary Party prepared a document over a year ago outlining our concerns with elements of the hate speech element of the bill, because it does deal with hate crime as well. And that is going to proceed. So I think it's wise. The minister herself said there was not a consensus on this. And that's not, I mean, this went through the Dáil without a whisper. Government and opposition in support of this legislation. It wasn't until it came to the Seanad that some of the, I suppose, the concerns that we would have had and others were really raised and debated and aired out. So it wasn't just opposition, it was government members as well were just not happy with that element of the bill, and we were looking for amendments on that. But I do think it's wise to, at this stage, to move forward with the hate crime element, because there is a broad consensus on that. And the main issues around the hate speech element were the lack of definitions. I know you had Danny McConnell on before that. The lack of a definition of hate and incitement, which we had raised, were concerns. And also the lowering of the threshold to bring a prosecution. I think that was, I just think that that's a risk, that you could end up having people convicted that really shouldn't be convicted of a hate speech crime. And also, I think there are still some concerns around the hate crime element, where you have to only prove now that you've demonstrated hate as opposed to having motivated by hate.
Very briefly,
issues to be worked through. And I think also, Matt, that the gender definition is also still part of the hate crime element. And I do think that needs a little bit more work. And that is a concern that Fianna Fáil has raised and other colleagues as
well. Okay, well, let me go
so
to finish
still work to be done.
With Alan Shatter. As a former Fine Gael Minister for Justice, do you applaud this decision by Helen McEntee to back off?
No, I don't. But can I say there's probably very little that Lisa and myself would disagree with in the context of problems with the bill. I think that it was as long ago as a year and a half ago. The Irish Times published an article of mine which was critical of the bill and major defects contained in this part of it. Despite that, all Dáil parties, including Sinn Féin, who are now pretending differently, nodded the bill through the Dáil. The difficulties with aspects of the bill were debated to a greater extent in the Senate than the Dáil. But it's an abject failure of government responsibility to withdraw this part of the bill. This legislation is very, very badly needed. The defects in it could be readily corrected. I'm astonished that they haven't been corrected. When Lisa references there being a lack of consensus around the bill, the lack of consensus derived from a dispute by Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil within government. And I'm not critical of Fianna Fáil for that, because I think they identified difficulties that hadn't been properly dealt with. And let me say one other thing on
this.
What is particularly extraordinary is the timing. The Minister for Justice on Friday announced the hate speech element of this bill was being recalled or taken out of it. On Thursday night, we had the very well put together prime time program dealing with protests, where it was absolutely clear to any decent person watching it, whatever problems local communities may have had, these protests were led by racist thugs who were intimidating the Gardaí. They were intimidating other people who were present. They were intimidating employees within the Crown Paints area,
yeah.
and they were threatening violence. And if anything illustrated the absolute need for proper hate speech and intimidation legislation, this did. The minister was wrong to withdraw it. They've withdrawn it for opportunistic political reasons, because we're close to a general
election. Okay, I've gone way over time. I have to finish. Thank you, Alan Shatter, and thank you, Senator Lisa Chambers, because we do have two guests about to come into studio to discuss the differences of opinion between the Taoiseach and President about homelessness. President Michael D. Higgins has taken issue with an interview that Taoiseach Simon Harris gave to the Irish edition of the Sunday Times yesterday, in which he said homelessness numbers are heavily impacted by the fact we are seeing many people seek protection in our country. We have two guests, Senator Barry Ward of Fine Gael in a moment, but Gary Gannon of the Social Democrats. Why do you have a problem with what Simon Harris said?
in the first instance, it's just factually incorrect. Those who are here seeking international protection and actually don't impact the homeless figures at all. The homeless people in their international protection system aren't able to avail of emergency accommodation. They aren't able to avail of emergency homeless supports. They're categorised in a very different way and actually don't make up the homelessness figures that your listeners would be familiar with, which are released every month. We now stand at 14,429 people homeless, but not one of that figure are people in the international protection system. What the Taoiseach was doing yesterday was answering a question about his own government's and success and previous government's failures in relation to homelessness and went for a scapegoat, which was migrants. I think it's dangerous in the environment that they're in. I think it was unbecoming of the Taoiseach, and mostly it was just blatantly wrong.
Senator Barry Ward, why has Simon Harris put out what Gary Gannon calls wrong information, and why is he scapegoating immigrants?
Well, Gary can say that it's wrong, but it isn't actually wrong. The fact is that in July, 46% of those people seeking emergency accommodation were people who were in had previously been in direct provision. So we know that it's factually correct. But what Gary does is he takes that, says it's wrong, and then ascribes a motive that's absolutely absent. What we know is, and I agree that, and we talk about homelessness as if it's a unitary thing, but the housing issues that we face are not caused by people coming here seeking international protection. They can't be, because they're not entitled to go into that system, and we wouldn't want to accommodate them. They're accommodated in much less acceptable situations than Irish people on housing lists are. But the reality is that in the context of emergency accommodation, that's people who don't have somewhere to stay tonight or next week or whatever it is, those figures are impacted by people here, because we know that up to April of this year, for example, there was a 17-year high in terms of the number of people coming into this country, 86,000 of 150,000 people coming from outside Ireland who were migrants who came here.
That's
of
wrong.
Course that creates
those were available.
One second,
a difficulty. Nobody's denying that. And what Simon Harris said was a statement of fact as to the impact that's having
on
emergency.
Sorry, can I just clarify
families.
Something? If people are coming out of direct provision, if they get permission to stay in Ireland, if they have nowhere to live, do they actually continue to live in direct provision, or do they seek to get onto the housing lists here?
There are two things. Once they have been granted refugee status or international protection status, they are entitled to seek some of the housing reliefs that are there through HAP and whatever else it might be. They are entitled to do that. And it's for that reason that they would leave direct provision to make space for people coming here seeking international protection who don't yet have that refugee status and have nowhere to stay. When they leave, they are always offered emergency accommodation. So nobody is taken out of direct provision and put into homelessness.
Sorry, is that the case, Gary Gannon? So that if people are leaving direct provision and if they can't find somewhere to live, then they will present into the homeless numbers, and that's what Simon Harris was referring to.
So actually, I might just give you some of the figures that we have from the second quarter report of this year as to why people...
Will that answer my question?
Yeah, so to answer your question, firstly, these are people who have been evicted by the state, one state agency into another state agency. That is a failure of government. But in terms, even if you address those numbers, for example, so you will have the quarterly report that captures the second quarter of this year. We would have released the homelessness figures, and there would have been an explanation as to why each person went into homeless accommodation. So, for example, of notice of termination, so people who had just been evicted or people who got a notice of tenancy, 351 people. Relationship breakdown or family circumstances, 395 people. People leaving direct provision, 177 people. So even if you were to take what Barry's point was there, it's still only the third highest cohort of people in the homelessness sector. So the Taoiseach yesterday could have easily just said, actually, people, the homelessness figures are being swollen by the fact that we don't have proper tenancy protection in this country. The fact that one state agency is a victim, one cohort of people into another state agency is another poor reflection of his government.
What Gary ignores is what the Taoiseach was pointing to was a significant increase in that third cohort. And it's now gone up and up and up because you cannot retain people in direct provision when they aren't entitled.
Sorry, 177 in a quarter is not a significant number, is it?
Very carefully. In July, which were the figures to which the Taoiseach was referring, 46% of applicants for emergency accommodation. These are the figures that have come directly.
So you have the figures for the second quarter, July is in the third quarter. Okay, what are they?
What he's referring to is July. He's referring to single applicants in Dublin specifically. In terms of the actual family number of people who are living family accommodation, that's much different. The Taoiseach was very careful with the figures he chose this morning because he was on the back foot. If you take those figures from the quarterly report, what he's referring to of people leaving direct provision is 12.2% of the actual number over that 3 month period. And the Taoiseach chose to point at that cohort and say they're to blame rather than his government.
There are lies, damn lies, and statistics. And if an argument of the six, well, yeah, I'm telling you what the Taoiseach said is factually correct.
Enough.
The reality is there has been a very significant increase in the number of people who were in direct provision are no longer in direct provision because they've had to make space for people who are not entitled
to. Okay, but Barry, even if it was factually correct,
yeah,
it's a dog whistling in the sense that it is a small proportion of the overall problem that we have in relation to homelessness, and what he's done is created headlines about being unable to cope with all of the immigrants coming to the country, and we know where that'll get us.
No, I don't accept that at all. What he said, he made a factually correct statement about the reality of the situation, and it's totally fair to acknowledge where the system is creaking, where it needs to deal with people. But let's look at actually what we've done in relation. We had a 17-year high, as I said, the 12 months up to April of this year, you had nearly 150,000 people coming to this country. And by the way, nearly 70,000 of them were Irish, UK and EU citizens returning to Ireland. But this country has coped with a massive influx of
people.
I'll tell you something, Matt, though. It has coped vastly better than any of the people like Gary ever said it would. If you go back 2 years, Gary and his party colleagues were saying we wouldn't be able to cope with 40,000 people.
Right.
We now have a situation where 150,000 people are going in per year.
And not
one of them needs to sleep on the street. There is an emergency accommodation bed available for every one of them. They choose not to take it, possibly, but there is accommodation available for every one of them. And that is an extraordinary achievement that is never acknowledged by Gary or his colleagues.
Would you like to walk down the canal there and see people who've been given tents and asked to sleep
All of
on the
whom
street?
Have been offered emergency accommodation,
I think
Gary.
You understand that words matter. You're a person who understands the law. In terms of what the Taoiseach did over the weekend, it wasn't so much effect that he said what he said. He chose one cohort of individuals and used it as a dog whistle. And we know who hears that dog whistle. You were looking at, you must have seen the RTE Investigates programme during the night, where misinformation is being weaponised within communities to spread fear and misinformation. And what the Taoiseach done there was manna from heaven for them same cohorts. It was extraordinarily disappointing, and there's no defence of it. Go back 2 years. You asked me to go back 2 years.
Let's talk about dog whistles.
No, let me go back 2 years.
You're taking what the Taoiseach
you
said.
The one
which
that said
we know is factually correct. You're taking it and you're misrepresenting. You know very well that the Taoiseach responds to questions from various parties. And in answering that question,
he gave a factually correct statement. Into the equation. So before Russia's invasion of Ukraine and the associated conflicts that came from that, there were still 5,000 people in direct provision who had status to remain, who still could not be accommodated. Mm-hmm. And so undoubtedly,
you say accommodated, you mean housed.
House accommodated. Yeah. Undoubtedly, any society.
You're talking about how important words are, so let's be clear about what we mean. We now have a huge influx of people coming here who are not refugees, who do not yet have international protection. They're going through
who
the system.
Qualify.
We have an obligation to accommodate them, and we want to accommodate them. But there are people in the places that they would otherwise be taking who are entitled to get on housing lists.
Okay, we're leaving it there. Thank you very much, Senator Barry Ward and Gary Gannon, TD of the Social Democrats, Barry from Fine Gael.
Last Word with Matt Cooper. Weekdays from 4:30. Today.